On this week's show, discussing from ABC to XYZ, the reality in construction, with Dave Mitchell from XYZ Reality.
Construction is the world's oldest industry, but spends the least amount of money on innovation. When we realized people outside the construction industry didn't typically associate construction with technology like virtual reality, apps, and robotics, we started the ConTech Crew. Each week, we bring our listeners the latest in ConTech news and interview the minds behind the technological innovations changing the way we build. So strap in, enjoy the ride, and geek out. It's ConTech Crew time.
All right, we're back. I got a special episode because it is rare when one of my friends calls me up and says, "Hey, man, I wanted you to throw somebody on the show, have a cool conversation, and I want to be with you." So, Charlie Dunn, welcome to the co-host seat today, buddy.
Hey, Jeff. Thanks. Good to be here.
Well, thank you. It's excited to have Dave with us. David, how are you doing this morning, my man?
I'm good. It's afternoon here out of London.
I was going to say, it's afternoon where you are, though, isn't it?
Yeah, it's good.
Well, I am really excited for us to dive in, have a cool conversation. We're going to go all over the place, so who knows where this one's going to go. Before we get crazy, though, let's pause for the cause.
Everyone supports a culture of well-being in the field and is equipped with the tools to help prevent suicide in construction. ProCourse Safety Qualified courses were built in partnership with our customers, elevating enhancements to their standard OSHA training. And the Bringing the Right Mindset series equips individuals and leaders alike with the skills necessary to really build resilient teams. We've made these three courses available for free and on demand, and they're offered both in English as well as Spanish, and they are CEU certifiable. ProCourse.com/certified-qualified is where we host our ProCourse learning portal, and anyone can use their ProCourse credentials or create a free account to get started.
All right, guys, I've been open with you about this. You got to like us, you got to subscribe, you got to share with your friends, you got to even leave us a review. And if you leave me a review on Spotify, I'll go check it. And who knows, you might get a mention on the show. You never know. And hey, don't forget youtube.com/@TheConTechCrew. Subscribe, like us, check out the shorts. They've been doing really well lately. Back in 2020, I heard about a new software platform called Join. Within minutes of seeing Join, I knew it had the power to revolutionize collaborative project delivery. In fact, I was so sold on Join that I joined the team as its industry evangelist. Many trade shows and podcasts later, Join is now used by 50% of the ENR top 30. Why? Pre-con and ops leaders at DPR, Bolt, McCarthy, Barton Mallow, Clark, and others say that they like Join because it does two big things: collaborative, trackable decision-making, and awesomely simple visuals. Want to learn more about the power of Join? Go to www.join.build/demo to learn about how better gets built. All right, now we're back. So we're going to start with you, Dave, because, you know, I'm not sure everybody listening in knows exactly who you are and what you're up to. So give us a little history before we go down this choose your own adventure with Charlie.
Yeah, I'll just give you a quick overview and then you can dive into any part of the story if you want to. So look, David Mitchell, founder and CEO at XYZ Reality. And what we've done is we've developed the world's most accurate engineering-grade augmented reality headset, specifically built for construction. This is here, right beside me. And it's the world's most advanced data capture solution as well. So we'll double-click on that topic a little bit more. So, but about my background, so father was a builder, learned to walk on a building site. First tool was a shovel and really kind of worked my way up through the ranks from there, you know. So started off on the west coast of Ireland building houses with my father, then moved into commercial construction management, then did civil engineering, became an architect for all my sins. The turtlenecks didn't quite suit me, so I moved back to major construction again here in London. Got to work on some incredible projects here, the Shard, Battersea Power Station, many more. And then really my last stage of my career before founding XYZ was building data centers around Europe. So that's just a quick overview.
I was going to say, that's a pretty quick overview. Although I do a lot of these and I hear a lot of people that come through the family, get their feet wet, so to speak, on that. But rarely is it a shovel. Usually it's a broom. So I don't know, maybe there's an interesting relationship with dad there on handing you a shovel instead of a broom, huh?
Well, there's not much concrete on the west of Ireland.
not a lot to sweep, I guess, huh?
Yeah. It's plenty to dig out there, but less concrete.
Plenty to dig.
But Jeff, I don't know if you picked up, but he just like name drops some epic projects. So David, this is one I haven't heard, so I'm interested to hear. What was your role on a Shard in London?
So the Shard was actually quite funny. When I got here, because like coming from architecture, I mean, it was been built for quite some time by the time I got here. But my first job on the Shard, I had many jobs. My first job on the Shard was actually in the waste disposal unit that was already active by the time I got there. So that was my first experience on the Shard. Then there was like building secondary steel framework for where they were making additions to the side of it. Avoiding post-tension rods in the slab and cutting holes. So I was working for J. Coffey Construction at the time, which is kind of like substructure and make modifications to existing builds. So really interesting. Got to work up the top as well to stop base jumpers from jumping off the top of the share. That was quite a cool project. So a lot of mini projects within a project.
What do you do to mitigate base jumpers?
Just put as much steel as you can. Block them in. But it was a cool project. Battersea was a great project as well. I got to float around a lot of different projects around London. Yeah, great place to work, London, for sure. I feel like there's... Compared to Paris was a lot more red tape around everything we did, whereas London is a little bit more lenient.
You've got to be the first that had to protect us from base jumpers or protect a structure from base jumpers. I'm sure we'll get a few people. That's got to be a clip of some sort. How do you prevent base jumpers?
Yeah, I'm just set a challenge now. Yeah. There'll be people trying to jump off now, but yeah, that was it.
Hey, you're not there anymore. It's not your job to keep them out of there anymore. Somebody else's job to keep them out. That's why we got security for that now. So,
but anybody out there repping fall protection, we'll give you another little hook. You can now do fall protection and base jumping mitigation if you get your solution right.
Yeah, I don't know that there's a lot of tech for stopping base jumpers, but I like the idea of throwing hardware at it. You know, that's what you got to do, right? Which kind of spin us back. This is kind of you built an actual headset, right? This is the difference. So we see a lot of solutions, right? In reality capture, it's a huge space right now. Visualization, mixed reality, wherever you want to kind of position it is really growing. And everybody comes at it from a different angle. XYZ, though, came at it from its own angle. And that was actually the genesis of talking to Charlie about you. So give the listeners an idea of, you know, what it is you've done with XYZ and the hardware that you've built along with it.
Yeah. So from the hardware perspective, this is it right here. But we built it from the ground up with construction in mind. So health and safety was number one. So the visor and everything complies with all the health and safety standards here in Europe and the US. Same with the shell as well. The shell is compliant with all the health and safety standards, both here and the US. And we want, like, fundamentally, we wanted it to be an engineering tool, right? So we wanted it to be able to be super accurate out on site. And be able to operate in difficult conditions, such as offline. You can't always rely on a Wi-Fi connection. So long story short, we can load, you know, the biggest, baddest 3D models out on site to millimeter precision and to the site coordinate system reliably again and again and again. And we've been doing so now since, 2017 is when we founded the business. So I'd say about 2019, we've been live in the field testing this.
So I want to spin this to, like, David's doing a good job of explaining it, but when Charlie explained to me the difference in philosophy. So Charlie, can you talk a little bit about when you two met and how
David impressed you with the way he was going versus where your head was going.
Yeah, so I'm still sitting here geeking out a little bit about this shard connection because there's a thread there that connects us. I was doing 4D planning with a product called Synchro in the nuclear industry. And
right.
A lot of the Synchro hype videos came from the shard. And some of us were like, okay, we get it. We've seen it. That's cool. But what else, right? Like the shard. And some of what we did in the nuclear industries, we really solved for problems that matter. We were cutting work to 40% to 10% of record time. This was work that they'd done every 18 months going back 30 years. So it wasn't like we just showed up and nobody had ever planned this work before. We just came in with a strategy for understanding field conditions, optimizing the manufacturing strategy, what happened out of the field, getting the precision, the quality right, because we always had pressure on quality. So some of the things that we were forced to do because of the pressure of a nuclear outage, David was kind of, I think, observing all these mega projects. And part of the story, I'm going to toss it back to him, was that because of this relationship with Synchro and a guy, Greg Dimchek, I was invited to Boston for the first hackathon for the HoloLens outside of Redmond. Like, I don't know if you guys know the history of the HoloLens, but Microsoft kind of cooked it up in a basement lab with no windows below the kitchen there in Redmond. Didn't let anybody else in the world know it was coming. And then they launched it, and the first place they did a roadshow was to Boston. And we took some of these nuclear models and loaded them. And at that time, this was summer of 2016, I remember thinking, hey, this is really cool, but I can't wait to see Gen 3, 4, 5. So jumping forward, Jeff, when I met David, heard his story, the light bulb for me was, okay, David had the same, hey, we need Gen 3, 4, and 5 for this to really solve for the things that matter in the field. But rather than me taking a, hey, well, I'll wait for the industry partners to go deliver it, somehow he had this crazy idea that I'll go build it. And I guess, David, tell us where you were when that idea happened, who was engaged with you, kind of those first steps of, let's go ahead and make our own tech that solves these problems, not 3, 5, 10 years from now, but gets them, shorter runway.
I mean, so at the time, throughout my, my career, over time, I became obsessed with this notion of paperless construction. You know, how can we get to a stage where we're not relying on 2D drawings? I mean, they've been around since the Egyptians, and that's, thousands of years ago now. So I was like, in parallel, studying architecture and getting into that side of the things, you could see 3D was coming hard and fast, and it was starting to penetrate into construction, and we had this thing called BIMAP. So I was like, okay, if only we could kind of connect the piece of the puzzle there and position that model out on site to millimeter accuracy, you could actually build from holograms. And that became it, builders building from holograms. And that's where we wanted to go. So I trialed some proof of concepts out there. One of them was actually with my previous employer, where I was pulled over to this data center project in Ireland. And they go, David, we've signed up to this thing called BIM. We don't have any drawings. I have 150 men out on site, and they can't do anything, because they have no drawings to work from. And I was like, oh, that's not good. So he got up over there, and I was like, right, okay. So I got some, like, three drafts people lined up, and it was taking the three drafts people, it was taking us like 3 days to keep this, to produce enough drawings to keep the site going for one day. So it was just like, oh, this is still not good. So I remember being at a site meeting, and the client was there, and my old contractor was, our boss was there, Jay Coffees. And I was like, we could do this with paperless construction. And I remember he's like kicking me the shin under the table, going, what the hell are you talking about? What's this? And I was like, yeah, we can do it. We can do it. So long story short, we hacked this system together. I just had some basic code. I wasn't a coder by any chance, but long story short, we just exported the line drawing of a BIM model out into all the machines out inside. I think you can do that normally now with anything. But back then, it was before that had come to market. And we went out to the field, and we gave a couple of people an iPad out in the field. We kind of picked people who had... some people don't want change. Some people are up for change. So we picked someone who was like, oh, yeah, that could be interesting. And it turned out he was actually five times faster installer works thereafter through that process. So that was like, boom, this is happening. So we went from a stage where it was taking three people to produce enough drones to keep the site going for one day to just me in 20 minutes could issue enough information to keep the site going for 3 days. So that kind of flipped it on its head. Turned to my employer, saw that job shrink to a level of maturity, turned to my employer and I said, look, guys, you've seen the benefits. I've seen it. I'm going after this and you can't stop me. And they go, well, don't go anywhere, David. We actually want to be part of that journey. And they preceded the business. So they got me off the ground, which is great, you know, that a subcontractor would back you, a startup, to go and build from holograms. And that's what got me going. So I'll stop there for a minute, went on for a bit.
Well, maybe then this is another part of the journey. I don't know the story. So you started with iPad. What was the, okay, we're going to leave the iPad and we're going to go straight to headset holographic technology?
Yes. So from there, I actually went to, I started, you know, tinkering around with different technologies. And I came up, the first iteration was actually like a projector you hold in your hand and you project the plans onto the floor. And then, so you'd upload your drawings and you can see the plans on the floor. But I was like, no, that's just not a big enough leap. I want to go beyond that. You know, I want to really push this. So I saw waveguides coming onto the market, which are these glass things here. So basically you can see holograms, and that got really exciting. And I saw the HoloLens at the time, and I experimented with the HoloLens. And I was like, wow, okay, if this is accurate, I can build something on top of this. But it had limited compute power, and it drifted as you walked through the site. Everyone knows the story with it, but it just wasn't good enough. So I was like, I really want to focus on engineering grade augmented reality. That's what I wanted to focus, because I could see everyone else was going quite broad over multiple sectors, limited compute power locally on the headset, and accuracy wasn't so important for them. So I doubled down on that and started drafting together a team. Murray was my CTO at the time, and I mean, they were all just mad enough to follow a crazy Irishman with a dream, I suppose. You know, we're going to get builders building from holograms. It was a big statement. I remember even going out to market after I'd raised that capital from my previous employer, trying to get institutional investment after that. This is like back in 2017. I used to go into a room and they'd be like, oh, David, what are you trying to do here? And I'm like, builders building from holograms. So... hardware, you know, and I'm like, yeah. And they're like, whoa. And what industry? Construction? I'm like, yes. And they're just like, get out. You know what I mean? So luckily construction tech has come a long way now, but back then it was a lot different landscape.
Yeah, you were way ahead at that point. I mean, people weren't even thinking 3D. When I'm thinking about the timing you're talking about, they were just thinking about digital plans on an iPad. That's when PlanGrid and others were, you know, just hitting their what we thought was a hype cycle. So you were a bit ahead of it. In fact, if you guys look back and listen, I'm sure my tried and true listeners will remember that when in that 2016 summer when the HoloLens came out, James had it and was wearing it on a few of our shows and freaking people out. So, but we found the same thing, David. We found that there was limitations to the drift, limitations to the accuracy, to the way it was going to work. And there it is. Charlie has the throwback up. If you guys are checking us out on YouTube, you got to check that thing out. It's the original one. And you're right, because there was no true competition, right? You had Magic Leap trying to do it. You had Google Glass trying to do it. But again, low compute power, low capabilities. So Microsoft took a real pause before it even released the version 2. So I think if you look back, you timing wise, you know, you had to have done it. If you were waiting around, your business would have been on the shelf getting dust right now. So, and I didn't know.
I got a question, and we'll get to how we met and kind of where the landscape is now. And there's a lot of exciting stuff, but what do you think is the toughest problem you've solved so far? Like of all the different tech stack, is it something in the hardware on the headset? Is it something in the data model? What would you say is the
biggest challenge? Well, it's two things. you know, we wanted, so if we were going to do this, we didn't want to start on the domestic side of the market. We wanted to start on industrial, you know, mission critical side. So we're very much on data centers, you know, in mission critical projects in general. So we want to be able to take these big, big models, like super complex, high level of detail. And so we had a challenge here on the 3D file format. So we've developed something on that side to be able to operate in an offline environment where you don't have to cut and carve up this model into loads of little chunks, that we can maintain it into, you know, we can maintain that federated model in the field. And it's not a different workflow than from your existing BIM processes. So that was important for us on the data modeling side of things. And we'll get more into the platform and what we do in the platform in a bit. But by far the biggest challenge on the hardware side is being able to accurately position holograms. That's a big task, you know, because you have to calibrate everything with such precision relative to each other, the cameras, the photo sensors, the wave guides, and then, you know, relative to a user's head and how they see through the lens, that's no mean feat. So to calibrate them all together in one go is a big task. And we've done it. So yes. But that took some time.
Yeah, certainly some iteration time there, right?
Yeah. And a lot of headaches. Some gray hair as well along the way. So
okay. You're not a true founder unless that happens, you know, they age you. There's a couple different ways to age yourself, and that is definitely one of them.
It's been fun. It's been a fun journey for sure.
It's got to have been also, given when you started, you had to have come up against a lot of resistance. What are some of the consistent resistance still to this day? And maybe what were some of the bigger hurdles? Like Charlie said, you had to get over technology hurdles. At least it's you versus technology, and the ones and zeros don't talk back. You know, people present lots of roadblocks along the way. So what were some of those roadblocks?
I mean, fundraising was difficult. Like we had, because like I said, it was construction tech wasn't like, this is like pre-plan grid exits, everything. Like construction was just like, what the hell are you talking about? Why are you talking to me? You know? So raising funds there was a challenge. But we interviewed, like, I'm not joking, it must have been 1,000 VCs. You know, like we must have went through 1,000 of them just to try and kind of go, look, this is a market that's changing. It will change. It just needs a pump from tech. You know, it needs investment. And there was two people, I'll shout out to Herman Hauser from Amadeus Capital. He was one of the founders at Acorn Computers, like, you know, the microchips and ARM and everything else. Now, he saw the vision and he went for it. And Hussein over at Hoxton. And, you know, they were our first institutional investors to kind of get us from a prototype to a commercially feasible product, should I say.
Yeah.
So that was great. And once we got our foot in the door, then it was all about, you know, standard metrics you'd report on as a startup. But getting there was difficult.
Yeah, so getting to that part.
There's a story there that kind of connects us, Jeff. So Greg Demchak, this was last year, was like, hey, this guy David's touring the US, you guys can connect, it'd be good. Or Greg knew I was coming to London and then doing a conference in Switzerland, one in France. It's like, maybe we've not connected in Europe, because Greg knew that when I was in the HoloLens and I saw the ability to make these challenging field conditions very simple and to show the field guys the story of how to do the work, like that was my aha. Like eventually this will be the thing. Like the effort we do now to make the field work simple, in the future, that effort be a much, much lighter lift. So it's like, yeah, you gotta get together with David. So I was flying out on a late night flight out of JFK. Had my luggage with me, and Jeff, you know what was in my luggage. It was some Lego, because I was going to do Flow State in Switzerland and at IGLC, International Group for Lean Construction in France. So come into my younger sister's favorite Spanish restaurant for lunch, and I'm kind of apologizing to Dave because I got a backpack, but then I got this bag, and I said, but it's not all my stuff. You know, travel heavy. I got Lego. And he said, Lego? And he was ready to pack it up, forget lunch, go find a place, and let's work on some Lego. and we didn't talk about anything tech or anything. Like, it was, okay, tell me why you're geeking out about Lego. And it was part of the hook in one of those first successful pitches. Is that right?
Yeah. 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 So, like, I used to, like, how do I communicate this to a venture capitalist? So I'd bring in two sets of Lego, and I would – this is the early days before we had prototypes, and I actually used HoloLens at the time, and I give one of the investors the 2D drawings and a set of Lego to put it together, and the other investor the HoloLens and a set of Lego to put it together, and without fail every time the guy with the HoloLens will win, and that was kind of a proof point for them. So then that was in their office, and then I bring them back to our — it wasn't even an office. It was like a basement room we had in the middle of London. I'd bring them down there, and then they'd wear a headset with a load of wires on it that was positioned accurately with the bigger Lego sets. I think they're Duo Lego or whatever for kids. So then they'd start building from holograms then in the office as well at scale. So that's what kind of piqued our interest and got us together on the Lego side of things.
Yeah, and that was, to me then, I guess, Jeff, the next thing I think is part of this is I've watched and observed, and you're nailing on the right thing. Like, the ones and zeros don't talk back, the people do. So David's had an interesting approach, I think, to challenge solving this people challenge in the tech. And I've seen him run into resistance in the U.S. because of the solution he came up with in Europe. So David, you know, as I understand it, your European data center contracts, you never just supplying the hardware. And you're never supplying the hardware and the platform, but it's always the hardware, the platform, and the experienced surveyor who works in the field.
100%. So, yeah, it's like we've talked a lot about the hardware up to this point, but really it's about the whole ecosystem. And we're like, it's one solution, you know, one device, one platform. And where we want to get to this ultimately is we kind of elaborated on this builders building from holograms. And I will just kind of round that story off. Like, we have people out there today building from holograms in Nebraska. And, you know, before we rocked up on site with our headset, they were setting out, like, I think it was 4 struts a day up in a steel truss roof. And it was taking four laborers as well, or 4 operatives to install. And they were doing 4 a day. And now they're using our headset, they're actually installing 50 a day with half the labor. So, you know, that's the vision is coming true hard and fast right now. And that's what we're all excited about. But equally so, we have this whole digital platform that we're leveraging today, whereby we're eliminating rework out in the field. These users are out in the field, stopping rework from happening in real time, but also capturing all the progress that's happening out on site. So, you know, every nut and bolt that's been installed, every beam that's been installed, we're able to capture exactly when it started, when it finished, how much labor was applied to it, and how much it cost to build. And then we federate that all up into a 3D model that distributes that data to all project stakeholders in real time. This is all happening in real time. And that's a game changer for people on their projects, because now it's just objective fact going forward. You're not looking over your shoulder or estimating where you are in terms of progress out in the field. You have a clear drop line on a daily basis of where you are. You know, it's real time. And that's been incredibly valuable to our customers today, because leveraging that data now, you can get all on the same page and solve the challenges to enable you to hit them milestones and actually build your project on time. And we've deployed this now all over Europe, pretty much every country in Europe, a number of projects over in the States now as well. We've broken into the States, India, and Japan. And what we've seen is, you know, one of our customers for the first time in their 20 years of existence building data centers have actually delivered their first project on time, right, within the schedule, because they have that real-time data and action that they can take in real time to prevent any works, abortive work going forward, and actually nail them targets. So it's been an incredible journey, and we're excited. We're just getting started, really.
Yeah, You hit a number of things there, David, that I don't think people are really understanding. There is an efficiency to it, right? So yes, you're helping out with efficiency, but you hit on something really key that you're putting a data platform behind it and reality capture for progress tracking, because one of the main reasons we're behind schedule on large projects is not having visibility over the problems that our teams are experiencing and not being able to react. It's not that we can't react. It's that by the time we know, it's sometimes too late to react. And so we're always chasing that. So you're moving the ball to the front for the team to collaborate and solve problems. I think, you know, Charlie, you're consistently talking about this. This is the key deal. It's not that we're going to eliminate.
Careful, don't steal my thunder here. I only got like two big ideas to bring to this thing. I mean, the rest of we just been having fun. So, and Jeff, you've heard it, but there, I come back to there's two simple things. If we create them, we're going to succeed. If we don't, we're going to be in a fight to get out of the project. And the first one is flow. And I used to talk about tact and lean and production, but now it's just flow. And if you have flow in the production science guys, manufacturing will tell you this, you don't focus on production, you focus on flow, you'll get production on flow. But then in learning about flow and you know that Lego thing is involved, we call the flow state experience. There's a psychologist who's actually described four requirements for flow: focus, freedom, feedback, and what he called the 4%. And so starting out, what David gives is that feedback. Like XYZ gives that feedback, and not weekly or monthly. Monthly, when I was learning Primavera, I came up with this image that, you know, a dude in the back of a pickup truck looking backward, like that's, or the, you know, the management by rearview mirror. Like that's what we normally are. If we're trying to consolidate data monthly, we're not making any intelligent decisions looking forward. We're just looking backwards, trying to figure out what happened. So that's that. It's that feedback that gives you the chance to have flow. But even more important than flow is this foundation of trust. And that's where, you know, starting, as I understand it, David, as the tech evolved, you realize, okay, I've got this long range go to build from holograms, but along the way, we're going to knock out some stuff that has value. We're going to try to get that to the market. So the, you know, quality.
Yes.
And obviously quality creates this trust. But this I see is really powerful as part of that second point is that freedom of, you know, focus, you got this right small batch, you're looking at daily increments, but freedom, a big part of freedom mentally is not being concerned that you've done the wrong thing. And so often our trades get bound up in this. Are we working in the right area? Are we hitting the right production targets? Is this work that's complete? Are we going to have to do rework? If we've tried to do offsite, is it going to fit? We get all these crazy questions that mean we don't have mental freedom when we go to work. We can't get the flow. And then that's where flow then really ties into that trust that when you have the right kind of trust, you're going to be free to go do the right work. I mean, I don't know how you pull this up to a short clip, Jeff, but what he just said, four guys, four beams a day to two guys, 50 beams a day. That doesn't happen without some huge fundamental change. And to me, the fundamental change comes down to that flow and all the characteristics that get you to flow, and then trust. And then that gets to the next thing that you're going after the quality bit is that production bit. Like, okay, we trust that everyone is essentially, a lot of trust in construction comes back down to, are we getting what we paid for? You know, if you put yourself in the owner's shoes, like I wrote these contracts, I bought this, you know, risk insurance, we've bought out all these trade partners. Am I getting what I paid for? And I've got one other connecting story that I'll hold for a little bit later on this trust concept. But I think, Jeff, that's what you were picking up on, is that, yes, some of these things you've heard me in workshops try to explain this build from holograms journey is solving for those things in a very powerful way.
Yeah. I mean, to spin on that for you, you know, flow state is about staying in it too, right? You want to be in it for particular amounts of time and really get rolling. And in construction, we trust, but we verify. Well, those are two very separate processes that cause people to have to come out of flow, run a whole different process to verify, right? Exactly. Because not because they're stupid, because they're, this is part of the quality checks and balances. Life needs that in construction, right? Like the reality of it is you're working in a physical environment where things and conditions can change a little bit, and you want to trust and verify and stay in flow. You've created a device that does that in concert and keeps them in flow for that period of time, which would explain a lot of the gains that we're seeing. So that's my take on what Charlie said. David, I'm wondering, you know, this is where sitting down with Charlie in a restaurant gets you to hear, right?
Yeah, but it's exactly that. It's built-in quality. And that's our whole philosophy, is like build it right first time on time. If you can have, rather than having, you know, all these reactive processes happening in the field, if you can kind of all build them in at the lowest value stage, you know, at the point of setting out or during construction, it's like a built-in checks and balances system. It just allows, you know, that output velocity to increase thereafter. And that's why we see, like, literally an order of magnitude in terms of improvement in installation. Like, it's done correctly. It's installed in the right location. You've reduced labor. You know, all these benefits start to click in then across the board.
So now, Jeff, you've seen me do the waste walk for the emotion of the waste of material on site. But David's leaning into another one on this quality question about the rework waste on site. All I had been able to say about it is we're blind to it, because that rework waste, we usually force people downstream to eat it. So that's where we destroy trust, right? Like, we don't want it to surface up. Maybe it eventually accumulates into a change order, but nobody ever really gets compensated for what that rework waste creates. So David, talk a little bit about that, about where you're seeing, how you've been measuring waste reduction and rework,
yeah,
and the metrics you're seeing from some owners on rework.
For sure. I mean, so in general, as a statistic, we've seen like between 7 and 11% of project costs are wasted on rework. That's kind of a broad statement. Let me kind of double click on that a little bit. Like, even furthermore, when we first started going out to the field with this headset, the platform was, you know, less mature, and we were just purely focused on quality at the time. And we had people going out, and they were spotting, you know, deltas left, right, and center. You're like, wrong. And it was just a blast of this information coming back to the project teams. Everything that was out by 5 mil or more, you know, so that's kind of information overload. So we've gotten smarter since then. Now that we connected up to the project schedule, you can really start getting smart now. You can go, okay, let's just focus on things category one instance and beyond along the critical path. So like a buzz bar in a data center, for instance, if that's installed incorrectly, you know, flag that. You know, second order would be any hard clashes that occur out on site. Third order would be any significant deltas out on site over 100 mil or a foot or whatever it may be. And then you have your minor instances, which are predominantly a lot of them. But you can really hone in on to what is the important elements that can really affect program and build quality out on the project now. And we're also getting pulled into, you know, the offsite manufacturing piece, factory witness testing. We're getting that pull as well, where we're inspecting in the factory, and we're bringing the site to the factory, right? And we're checking all the key interfaces there before they ship it. So that's been a game changer. That's a lot of that's happening in pharmaceutical works as well, which Charlie would know about too. But some really useful interactions going on. It's super exciting. I mean, what an incredible industry we work in. You know, we got like, we're all super creative and we like to solve problems. So like, people are always coming to us all the time. Hey, we can do this. We can do it that minute. So a lot of the time is, how do we filter that down and go for the low hanging fruit whilst we build out this massive platform in the future?
Well, I'm gonna say you hit a couple of things. First, I'm gonna say we, and I say this a lot, and I get in trouble because, you know, we're an industry full of problem solvers, and I'm like, we're an industry full of problem creators too. So like, we could really use to like maybe limit the amount of times we use our problem solving capabilities and maximize them. Just my take on it. But I love that you went, David, to offsite, because Charlie has not experienced this yet, but we learned from Charlie on play and game. And we did this at a fabrication conference. Christina and I, Henkai, did this where we took through a team through games, And we actually simulated this, Charlie, where everything they were building in the factory, they knew eventually was not going to get used, but they were pushing it through anyway because they get paid on it. And you should see the change in the overall emotion of that group and how it impacts the quality, the productivity, the experience. So I love, David, that you're connecting these two together so that we can continue to offsite and bring the factory or the building to the factory, because it's the only place we can really push, right? You can reduce waste on site, but you can't reduce it as much as you can reduce in a factory, right? As we start to fabricate in our fabrication facility. So super cool that, you know, I would love to see how we simulate that at some point to show people like this is how you connect the two. And if you're doing that, if I'm not mistaken, the other piece here is if it's quality checked, then it can be paid for, right? Because one of the problems with fabrication, let's be honest, is they're front loading all the payment for it. They're getting the materials, they're doing the work, they're paying for the labor. And our current construction model here in the US, I don't know if it's different in Europe, but you know, it's you don't get paid till it's installed. So that's two significant problems that you're addressing.
Yeah, like we're getting pulled in a lot of directions. Some of it's down to payment on install. You know, there's a lot to be said here for the future, but ultimately what we're capturing right now today is we're capturing so much data, clean data as well, because we're there every day. You know, it's live data. It's not just a snapshot once a week, right? We're getting that data as the building evolves and is actually constructed, that we're getting to know contractors better than they know themselves. And that's what we want to be able to tell them, you know, is that we're not here with opinions. We're just here with facts. And here's a data model now that you can use to improve your project's performance going forward. You know, how you perform in this region, how you perform in another region, you know, what trades are best on this job versus another job, you know. So really getting into that granular level of data, I think is going to be key over time on how people look at it from a portfolio as well and how they improve building these faster and faster and faster.
Yeah, I want to take that. I'm going to spin it to a question to Charlie from it, because I'm hearing something else as you're saying that. Two things, Charlie, you're always harping on when we do these workshops is we're constantly putting people, oh, there's no work going on over here. Get a crew over there, right? We're constantly moving people around and not understanding the impact. And we're not armed with data to say no. We are on schedule. We are hitting our targets and things are moving how they should. And if you do that, you will disrupt us. So you have given us, you know, I think what David and the team are doing is giving us an opportunity to prevent that. The second one is, and this just came to me while we were talking, I'm thinking back to our time in Detroit in that killer car, that BMW you had, and your analogy of we're always looking out the back. And that's what I've always said is construction is just spending its time running into the wall because we're looking over our shoulder at what we're doing. Now you have the heads up display of that BMW car. So you know what's going on behind you, to the side of you, in front of you, and you're driving to your destination consistently. So I'm interested as you put those things together, Charlie, what your thoughts are on it.
Well, and I'll drop in a third that, and this I think, Dave, was kind of one of those kind of ancillary. You had to solve for it along the way and maybe didn't appreciate the value of it till you saw it. But I saw it immediately when I first looked at their platform. And here, maybe we've jumped past, like, assuming everybody knows what's in the XYZ platform. So maybe at some point, Jeff will give David a chance to kind of walk down through it. But one of the things that they've been able to do as regards data is ingest the model. And because they've tracked at the object level all these data center builds, they immediately build a schedule of values from the object level rolled up to the project. So this other challenge we have with data where I say we're project focused and one project at a time, we never get better. We need to become enterprise and then become global. Like along the way, while trying to build from holograms, David solved for a global data model for data center construction. Like everything we need at the right level of detail, they've solved for it. And what that is going to open up, it is going to then, you know, pull back to the things you talked about, your one and two. Your one, hey, come with the facts. We are executing per plan. Don't disrupt us. Don't pull us to another space. Don't say this thing over here is critical because you just happen to walk the site and you feel like it's critical. You know, like let us stay in flow. You know, 15 minutes from where I sit, that was one of the biggest lessons I learned from an ex-VP who'd come back to get a project across the line at McGuire Nuclear Station. Like, and Jeff, I like this where I'm going to lean back to this other thing you said, because this is where that it kind of reinforces the point. There's a difference between being in flow to put work in place and being in a quality check / production validation mode. So what I saw this guy Skip Steele do is he protected the team that had to put work in place. And he told the observers and he told the project controls teams and he told the executives from downtown, these are the two times a day when I will come to this room and meet with you. And beyond that, you leave my team alone. You don't come out in the field and stop work or question things or challenge things. You don't pull those guys out of flow. So anyway, so that was your number one. And yeah, absolutely, Jeff, you got it. And then the number two on, what was your number two?
Your BMW, man. How right, can you BMW, forget your BMW?
Yeah, heads up display. Well, then that's a perfect place for me to toss it to David. So what does the platform look like right now? And then maybe I'll give it to you two part. What does the platform look like now? And what's that short term next year or two enhancements, you know, to the platform?
Yeah. So like we feel like we're just at the start of the journey. So like literally today with the headset, you can go out on site with this and you can create like a mirror world reflection of that in the cloud that's distributed across to every project stakeholder. So exactly where you are, you know, and like it uploads literally every time they go to the site office. So that gives you a mirror world reflection. So that's like drawing a line in the sand of exactly where we are today. But now we're moving forward is leveraging that data to do scenario analysis on how resource optimization, exactly what you're talking about, Jerry. Like do essentially based on your performance up to this point in the project, we can then do a backwards pass on the program to say, okay, you know, the likelihood of you succeeding in your next milestone is X amount because of your past performance, you know, and if the likelihood is below a level of risk that the project team isn't comfortable, reroute that schedule that is, you know, so that you still in hit their milestones, or increase labor in this area so you can hit their milestones. That predictability and scenario analytics is really what we want to drive for the remainder of this year. So really what you'll end up with is like a graph of, you know, your X and your Y, which is time versus cost. And you want to pick the scenario that's like bottom left-hand corner. What can be done in the lowest cost at the quickest time and really optimizing the schedule going forward with that. That's what we would like to accomplish this year. And then leveraging them analytics across the portfolio. I think that's key for us.
And again, this is not a software demo chat, but yeah. it was powerful just observing that web UI that any stakeholder in the project can see that it might be easy to take for granted the lift and the value of what's there. But so it's not just the guy in the field on the headset, but other project stakeholders, what do they see in that quality production platform as it exists right now? Yeah.
So we kind of, if you imagine how that used to exist, it'd be like multiple silos between multiple parties. Now that's all stored on an online browser where you can access like a 3D model. And we kind of made it as simple as, you know, green is good, red is bad. You know what I mean? So it's like green is installed, you have no problems. Red, it's either late or there's a problem with this element. You double click on that element, you get a drill down analysis of exactly what's wrong. You can get a burn down of each package in each zone to know what's behind and what's on program. So you can actually fix these problems in real time to move forward.
And then there's some roll up like by schedule values percent complete in parallel with by schedule percent complete. And there again, some stuff I learned in nuclear, we called all these metrics essentially different views of the weather. And one view alone might mislead you. But as you begin to stack these views based on real data from the field, your confidence level again goes way up. And you know, in my experience doing this manually without the automated field process was that at least making the investment to do it manually, we eliminated this crazy question of what is our percent complete, which to me was just maddening. Like, why do we ever ask this question? Why is this not coming from data on the model?
It's funny we're this far along, Charlie, and that is still, it just drives me crazy because there's so many different ways people are trying to quote unquote calculate it. And you're like, yeah, every one of those calculations goes back to somebody uses their eyeballs to look at something. And that's just always flawed, right? They know too much. So, and they know what you expect of them. So, you know what they're going to say is even if they're trying to report as well as they can. Humans overestimate. We estimate positively, consistently. That's just the way we are, right? Like every estimator probably has some sort of calculation where it's like, well, I think we can come in here, but I've been this much off every time, so I'm going to push it and change it. And you're taking some of that out, David, and removing that human piece to provide, again, real data so we can make real decisions. I mean, informed decisions is the future, and the data model itself that you're creating is the future. I mean, Charlie has hit this over and over, and I agree. Like, we just don't know what we don't know, and we've never focused on creating it. So right now you're doing it in data centers. My question, and critical infrastructure projects, I would imagine, or critical projects, where can you see this thing going? Obviously, you've got to stay focused for now, right? That's part of being a company. That's got to be hard because there's got to be a lot of shiny toys for you to chase. And there's probably people lined up at your door who've seen it going, I want it on my project. Where do you see this going? What kind of impact can it have? And then, you know, for you, what's the next few steps that you think you can tackle?
So we really want to solve for the most difficult projects first, and then from there kind of siphon it across general contractors' portfolios, subcontractors they can take from there. So we wanted to master one vertical, if not two, before we branch out. And then it's really down to economies of scale and everything else. Like we literally want this, you'd be able to pop down to your local Lowe's, grab a headset, you know, pop it on, go out, you're a bricklayer, block layer, you see your wayfinder path out to where you need to build that wall, you know how many blocks you need to build the wall, how much mortar, etc. If it's not there, you can order it through the headset, but meanwhile, it's capturing all this data in real time. There's so much more we can do with this technology. We're just getting started, but that's ultimately where we want to get to.
Yeah, it's going to take you some time and some, I would say, constraints. You're going to have to hold back along the way, but I think it's interesting because most people start with the easiest and then really run into a roadblock trying to tackle things that are truly complex and harder. So I like the idea of going in the opposites. Charlie, before we wrap it up, I'm wondering what final questions you got for David, since you know, this is a fun one to bring you on.
Well, I am now. So it occurs to me, I've started saying this thing. I really only have one skill. I may have many talents, but that one skill is serendipity. But it occurs to me, David, like you've had some serendipity in your path. Like one, timing this kind of effort as the venture market heated up so you could have access to capital to go do this crazy tech thing. But then two, what I don't know is what led you to data centers. Because again, in the market, like we were forecasting massive demand in data center work, you know, markets 2018, halfway through 2017, 18, 19. And that was before AI, ChatGPT, all that stuff took off. So now our forecasts, like they were bleak then, they're even worse now, like the demand for construction. So what it appears to me, not only are you perfectly suited and it's a challenging high-tech project, but it's also you're in a market sector where the demand is only going up. And everybody we talk to in the U.S. is worried about their labor supply, particularly electricians. So what was it on your journey that put you in the data center sector?
It was just experience, like from prior to starting XYZ, I suppose, was like the appetite was there. The client's appetite was there. You know, they have interest in tech, the speed and velocity. And you could see that market was growing. Like you said, Charlie, it's like, you know, you're only as healthy as the hand that feeds you, and that market is exploding right now, right? So we knew if we could sit in that wave, that we continue to grow with it. And I think that the people within data centers are phenomenal people as well. Like, they're passionate. They want to move the needle. They're, a lot of them are cookie cutter projects. So you can measure efficiency from one to the other as well, right? So they're just a different mindset. And then, as you can see, the general contractor then can pull them learnings into the other verticals as we progress. So we just seeded ourselves there. And I think we made a good bet, and we're happy we made that bet.
Yeah, I can definitely see, Jeff, you hit on it. Like, a next market is going to be pharmaceutical. You know, it's painful. We'll finish the construction completion, and then they'll struggle for a year or two to be through all the regulatory inspections, approvals, checks to actually make a drug. And so that year to two window, and this is where the pain you talked about in that game, where people were building offsite, knowing it wasn't going to actually be used in the field. Pharmaceutical industry goes through that when they try to do what they call a boundary condition, so that they can do the regulatory inspection offsite. As long as they maintain the boundary condition with discipline, then the regulatory paperwork is thumbs up. But what they've experienced is they always miss something. And it's a case similar to these other challenges where the tech is simply not there with a platform like XYZ. You could see them doing this earlier work, establishing the right boundary conditions. You know, and then the excitement for me is we can begin to final commission certain components before we even start field construction in the field. But to do that, we're going to have that trust in the technology to enable that boundary condition discipline. So that's a future, you know, but again, it's another huge opportunity where the speed to market for drugs, that a lot of these are drugs the world, you know, really needs faster. It's going to be fun to watch that one. I got one other connection, but I wanted to give you any other thoughts you're having here, Jeff, before I go to that one.
Well, that was a great one, because that is huge, Charlie, because there's two things, right? We need, that a lot of times as pharmaceuticals, they know that's coming and they can really get ahead. But you're right. Like, for those year or 2 years, there's two things happening. And let's be honest. One is profit loss, right? Like, they're losing money the entire time they're not producing that. And their time is running out, right? They only have 5 years before somebody can make a generic. So they have that. Secondly, the big one, the time it takes to get this to the people who actually need it. And don't kid yourself, the costs that it takes to get that to that point and maintain those boundary conditions and maintain those things can really add cost. So this would be cool too, because David's headset would be able to maintain that boundary through technology throughout the time. And again, you have a whole facility built off site, mostly installed on site, and be able to commission, you know, in a quarter of the time, because there's still going to be things that have to be done on the site, right? Let's not ignore reality, but we can amplify reality. So that's super cool. And I'll give you, what's your last one, Charlie? Because that was where my head went.
Oh, I got one more question for David, and then one last story. But so the question for David is, have you identified an installation detail that then the feedback loop, the owner/design team has changed something, either offsite or field install detail based on the feedback loop you're creating, either within an existing project or a future project? Yeah.
Have they changed the design detail? Is it?
Right. Yeah. Something where, hey, we the data is showing us we keep getting hung up on this thing. So can we design it better so that we don't have the rework quality, et cetera, problem?
I don't have any stories I can click on there, but I'm sure there are out there. I'll circle back to you on that for the next pod. We can go through that.
Yeah, because to me, that's another one of those opportunities where the knowledge we gain in the field, we just flush it currently. All this great field intelligence, it just dies with the project. And so having that ability to capture and see the insights and focus on these are the types of things to stop doing or to do better to make that field installed. You know, again, this becomes an enabling kind of baseline
yes.
to measure against. So yeah, that'd be a good story for next time.
So that's it won't mature. That's what we're capturing right now. So we won't be able to provide the analytics till later this year. But once we do, that's when that data will kind of come out in the wash. What are we doing? That's a retrospective, and we got some really cool announcements later this year. We can chat about. We're on about 1.2 gigawatts of data centers right now. We're capturing this data. You know, we don't cross-pollinate right now. We do it specifically for each customer. But like the data and insights piece alone that we can leverage from that, that we can show moving forward, is going to be incredible. So I'll hold that one back until
So there have been two times in the last 5 years, Jeff, and one of these stories you've heard, the other haven't, where I was in the room, somebody said something that was profound, made a lot of sense, and I had no answer for it. The one you've heard me talk about is the PPI, Project Production Institute guys, talking about WIP equals time. And from manufacturing background, I knew that was true, but I was like, okay, how do I see my WIP? And XYZ becomes one of those things that enables us to see work in process the way you would in manufacturing, that in currently in construction, we just don't see it and understand the impact. But the other one happened December 2019, a fellow named Denton Wilson spent his life in healthcare, which I think is another obvious next step for XYZs into healthcare. But he was on a road show around Charlotte primarily because he was working for an owner that had destroyed trust in a market. He had to go to 62 different entities to say, the naming has changed, the leadership has changed, we are not going to be the owner you knew, because the landscape was littered with trades and GCs are like, been there, done that, have the scars, we're not working for those guys again. And a very good presentation on the power of a lot of things. BIM, he talked about trust, and not just trust, but vulnerable trust, the need to have what he called his CFM time, which was cold, frosty mug time at the end of the day. And all of that was clicking for me. He did kind of lay down a nugget that he, as an owner, he wanted more prefab so that his teams would stop changing their minds. He had identified the damage of late decisions that created rework. And so his answer for why prefab was early decisions that stick. But then he said this. He said, now, if I were starting a company today as an owner, the thing I would encourage somebody to think about starting for me is, I'm investing in all this BIM stuff because I believe in it. But as I walk the field, I really don't have confidence that I'm getting what we designed. So again, this is December 2019. He said, if I were starting a company today, I would start that kind of company so that I would know in the field I've got exactly what I designed and bought. So to me, 5 years later, that's where XYZ is. That simple thought at that time was like, okay, I don't know who's going to put all that together. You guys, you've got most of it put together, and short term, the rest of it is going to be ready to get into production. So that's cool.
Let's go.
I like it. That's how we're going to end it, baby. Let's go. David, I'm excited. I know we won't see you in the States for a while here because you got some stuff going on yourself. It's going to keep you just staying in Europe for a while, but you've got to let us know when those things are releasing and when you're finally free to get back to the U.S. We'd be excited to see you here. And man, I'm just excited that you sat down and spent the time with us today and kind of removed some of the mystery behind what XYZ is doing and giving us some reality on, I guess, reality, right? That's how we're going to phrase it.
For sure. So, well, thanks, Jeff. Thanks for having me on. And shout out to Charlie as well. It's people like him out in the industry pushing for change and make things happen too. So let's do it.
Yeah, it's really funny, Charlie, but I remember having a talk about David from the Talk IGI conference. I was there in Nashville, which is interesting because you guys were just talking about Nashville before the show, but I was in Nashville and you're like, Jeff, you got to see this thing. You got to talk to this guy. This is going to be crazy. It took us a little while to put it together, but I'm psyched we put it together, man. Charlie, this was a good one, buddy.
Hey, thanks for giving me this chance. Always good to connect. And the other thing, just so everybody knows, listening, like, David's got a team in the U.S. So yeah, he's got, how is it that Christina said it? He's got an addition planned.
Yeah.
They're expecting their third, soon. So yeah. So David's got an addition planned. He's excited for that addition. That's going to keep him Europe bound. But yeah, he's got a whole team and we're working on multiple fronts trying to get the tech in. So Yeah, let's
rock and roll.
Let's plan that time to get together in person sooner rather than later. Jeff, maybe it's you and me getting over to London for next build, next dev. We'll see how that goes.
Hey, I love a good opportunity to go over that way. So let's talk about when we get that done. I want to thank everybody for tuning in today to Geek Out for our interview with David Mitchell. To read all our news stories, learn more about our guests, and to listen to the show, visit thecontechcrew.com. This is the Contech Crew signing out. Until next time, enjoy the ride and geek out.